Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. Also, a big shout out to everybody around the country that is taking Let's Talk via the National Indigenous Radio Service, NIRS, beaming us into your communities across the country. So good morning to all of you mob out there. Yesterday, we played a repeat of my interview with Melissa Lukashenko, Deadly Guri author. I was playing an interview that I did last week with Ramesh Fernandez from Rise. The file was corrupted, but that interview was discussing the PM spill and also the new PM sort of decision and outlook on refugees. Rise is a very unique organization where the organization is run by refugees, ex-refugees, ex-detainees and asylum seekers, non-government funded, which is, you know, pretty good. And also, you know, you're hearing the stories and the organization is being run from the people who are most affected by the, people that they're, supporting to, start a fresh life here. I will get that interview to play later this week because it was a really good yarn we had. So big thanks to Ramesh for you know, sharing some time last week. But on the show with me this morning, I have Chris Graham. How you going, Chris?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Bo. Really good.
And obviously, our listeners will know of you, but just for the ones that don't. Or the ones that most people don't think that they know you. Could you just a bit of background?
Yeah, sure.
Why are you and what you do?
I currently work as the general manager of NIRS, the National Indigenous Radio Service, but I'm also the editor and publisher of New Matilda, which is an online magazine. Aboriginal Affairs is one of our kind of main focuses. But prior to that, I was the managing editor of Tracker magazine and also the editor of the National Indigenous Times, and a very regular guest on Let's Talk in the olden days.
Yeah. You've seen, I guess in your time, you've seen many different hosts of Let's Talk.
I have, yeah. All of them glorious.
But we've got you on this morning to have a yarn about a recent trip that you did that got you in a bit of trouble, and I guess you knowing that you're going to go on this trip that you were going to get in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, I did. I knew where I would end up, which was an Israeli prison.
Yeah.
I was well aware of that before I went. And look, to be honest, the trip, it played out exactly as we'd kind of thought it would. It was almost to the letter. Yeah. Basically, I'd been approached a few months back by a group called Freedom Flotilla Coalition in Australia. The Australian group is part of an international group that every year or so they send a series of boats with activists from Europe to through the Mediterranean Sea, headed for the port of Gaza, which is obviously in the Gaza Strip, home to more than 2 million Palestinians. They do it every year because for the last decade, Israel has had an air, land and sea blockade on Gaza, which has, for a variety of reasons, utterly crippled Gaza as a place to live. The United Nations, for example, released a report a year or so ago which estimated that Gaza would be unlivable by 2020. That report's been revised to say 2019 it will be unlivable. It's not just the blockades that have left Gaza in such a bad way, it's the regular assaults by Israel on Gaza. They've launched a series of major attacks in, over several decades, but the most recent was in 2014, which essentially it killed nearly 2,500 Palestinians, most of them civilians, and it destroyed basically whatever was remaining of the infrastructure from the last time Israel attacked them, which was, I think, 2008-09. So, and actually, no, there was an attack in between then as well.
Mm.
So basically it's an area, Gaza is called in sort of international circles, it's known as the world's largest outdoor prison. And effectively, Gazans or Palestinians living in Gaza cannot come or go from their own country. It's not a particularly huge area of land, but it's a very, very densely populated area of land. But they're prevented from leaving Gaza or coming into Gaza. So if you happen to get out and the border between Egypt and Gaza is only open a couple of times a year, if you get out, you're then... there's no way you'll necessarily get back in, but there's no way you can necessarily get out either. I mean, people with cancer, for example, who are seeking treatment internationally have not been let out of Gaza.
And like you did mention, like the air, sea, and land blockade. Yeah, so you just tried to come in through one end, but then for our listeners as well, if you could explain, I guess, like the blockade on the other side where the land is and like the massive wall.
Yeah, Israel's built an enormous, well, they've built several walls, but they've built one major, they call it a security fence between Gaza and Israel. Earlier this year, people who follow international affairs would have seen massive protests at the wall by Palestinians in Gaza. They were called the Return March protests, and essentially they marked 70 years since the Nakba, which the Palestinians call the Nakba, which means the catastrophe. 70 years ago, Israeli soldiers and militias basically drove Palestinians out of the West Bank, which is another part of Palestine separated by Israel from Gaza. 700,000-odd refugees were driven out. There's now about 5 million Palestinians living outside of Palestine as refugees. And the Return March protests were about Palestinians demanding their right of return to their homelands, which Israel denies. Israel says they're not welcome back and they'll never be allowed back. Neither them nor their ancestors, their descendants. So those protests saw more than 150 Palestinians killed. They were unarmed. You can Google the footage online, but it is extraordinary footage. Essentially, heavily armed Israeli soldiers just shooting dead. Flag-waving, unarmed Palestinian protesters.
Yeah, I remember watching some of the footage, and they even had drones that were armed as well.
Yeah.
Like spraying gas. And
Look, Israel is an incredibly creative nation, in particular creative in the way they control and kill people.
And there's a link with, I guess, the apartheid style that Israel used.
Yeah.
Linking back to Australia.
There is. I actually wrote a feature on this for Overland magazine not long before I went on the trip. Essentially what Israel has created is an apartheid state, and they reinforce that all the time with new legislation. There was legislation passed, I think, while I was on the boat, which was 3 or 4 weeks ago, which sought to acknowledge Israel as a Zionist state, a home for Jews, and entrench rights for Jewish residents that other residents don't enjoy, such as Arab residents who are not Jewish. But everything about the Israeli state resembles apartheid. There's no denying it. Israel's very sensitive about the use of that word, but it is an apartheid state. And the feature I wrote looked at the comparisons between the experience of the Palestinians and the experience of Aboriginal Australians. Over several hundred years, Palestine's been suffering for 70 or 80 years, a bit longer depending how you calculate it. But there's a lot of similarities between the experience Aboriginal people have suffered and the experience that Palestinians have suffered. The reason why I wrote the feature is because 2 years ago I went to, not quite 2 years ago, I went to Israel and travelled through the West Bank for a couple of weeks. And I was actually quite, you know, I'd been reading about Israel and Gaza and Palestine for many, many, many years. And I had an image in my head about the level of poverty I would find and the oppression. And it was certainly stark. The oppression is something else. Israel has perfected apartheid. But the thing that surprised me is you know, having travelled Australia extensively over decades, looking at and reporting on the situation Aboriginal people face, what really surprised me is that the level of poverty you see in Palestine is not comparable to the level of poverty you see in Australia amongst Aboriginal people. It's worse in Australia, which really did surprise me. I mean, there's, you know, there's extreme poverty in Brisbane, but there's extreme poverty in remote areas of Australia where people might earn a wage, you know, through CDP or what have you, but it's a couple of $100 a week, which is obviously more than the average Palestinian earns, but the cost of living in these areas is extreme. And so, you know, poverty is relative, and it's one of the things I came to understand from that earlier trip. So this latest trip was that earlier trip in late 2016, I had tried to go to Gaza as well and was prevented by Israel from going to Gaza. They literally control all parts of the border by land, air and sea, but journalists are routinely not allowed in either. You know, a democratic nation like Israel twisting itself in knots to explain why it's not letting journalists into, you know, a country is pretty funny to watch. But so I tried to go there before, was refused, and I thought, well, I was offered an opportunity to report on the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, which was attempting to break the blockade in July. So I thought, well, I'll have another crack at getting to Gaza.
And you're listening to Let's Talk. My guest in the program, on the program this morning, is Chris Graham, editor of New Matilda, and also the CEO, or like the boss, up at National Indigenous Radio Service, which is in the building here with us as well. We're yarning about his recent trip to I'd like to say to Palestine, but didn't make it.
Didn't quite make it.
Yeah, I was stopped. Went ahead to a quick song break, and I'm going to come back after that. Want to yarn a bit more about the trip and the experience on the boat as well.
Sure,
If you can.
Yeah.
If there's nothing sort of holding you back.
No, nothing holding me back.
Okay, deadly. This song I'm going to head to is Glenn Scuthorpe with No More Whispering. You might remember this song actually from the Utopia documentary that came out in 2014.
Yeah.
And you was actually in it?
Yeah, I was in it. I was the associate producer of it.
Yeah, yeah. And Amy?
Amy McQuire was the researcher. She set up a lot of those great interviews.
Yeah, no, it's a deadly documentary worth watching if you haven't seen it. You're listening to Let's Talk.
Down over my hometown, the night became so still. Going north on a weekend run, a young man I knew well. No more whispering in our minds, no more whispering in our hearts. Gonna rise up, break these chains, and stop these killing games. One less loved one at Christmas, one less loved one on birthdays. But that smile won't be forgotten. Cain, you'll never fade away. All the joy that you gave us, the twisted jokes and all, we're gonna rise up for you now, and for the rest who have gone. But no more whispering in our minds, no more whispering in our hearts. We're gonna rise up to make a change, to stop these killing games. So the night was blessed with evil, and the soft rain began to fall. Walking through the park at midnight, coastal town on early morn. The shots ring out in the darkness, blood on the ground where he lay. Bitter tears will fall tomorrow for the rest of our days. But no more whispering in our minds, no more whispering in our arms. We're gonna rise up to make a change and stop these killing games. So there's two sides to the story. Yeah, one black and one white. One is fueled by the hatred, just to take another's life. So the families are destroyed now by the hand that held that gun. It's what the white man he swears by, the black man on the run. But no more whispering in our minds, no more whispering in our arms. We're gonna rise up, break these chains, stop these killing games. We'll miss him for the game today, when they run for the black and white. The colors of Cadougal, yeah, those mighty magpies. So let's all join the line of honor, raise our glass to Cain, a son of a father, child of a mother and a friend, two sisters and a brother.
This is Bo Spearum with Let's Talk.
And you're back on Let's Talk. What a great song by Glenn Scunthorpe, No More Whispering. As we said before the yarn, that song featured on the documentary that Chris was involved in, also Amy McGuire, journalist, deadly journalist at that as well, and who used to host Let's Talk here as well, and was a regular guest before that. With the old fella as well.
She was, yeah, and was my first cadet at the National Indigenous Times.
Mm.
An absolute guru.
Yes.
Yeah, she's gone on to well outstrip my achievements and
off,
profile.
Off air, yeah, you told us a bit of a funny story when it was on the boat.
Yeah, there was a British journalist named Richard.
Who for?
He works for Press TV, which is an Iranian state television,
mm-hmm.
So considered an enemy of Israel because Iran and Israel are bitter enemies. And Press TV is considered a terrible, terrible, bit like Al Jazeera but 10 times worse in the Western media. I think Press TV's work is excellent. Yeah. I think Al Jazeera's work is generally excellent. But he's a Press TV journalist based in London, British guy but Middle Eastern background. And we were chatting away, and I was wearing my new Matilda T-shirt, and he looked at my shirt and said, "Oh, new Matilda, do you know Amy McGuire?"
did he know, or just followed the stuff?
He follows the stuff. Yeah, yeah. He knew. He just offered it up. He just kind of he saw the logo and it twigged, and he went, "Oh, Amy McGuire."
Yeah, deadly.
Bloody Amy McGuire. Yeah. She hasn't worked at New. Well, she still occasionally does stuff, and Amy and I are very close friends, obviously. But she's well and truly. I've got 30 years of journalism behind me, and she's outstripped my. reputation and achievements in she's been better known and doing better things than I've been doing for like 5 or 6 years. So
yeah, no, she's very, very deadly at what she does.
Yeah, she's very good.
And that story too, that she's the Kevin Henry story that she's been continually reporting on, is something should follow more often as
Curtain,
well.
The podcast, Curtain.
Yes,
yeah.
Mm. And on the program as well, we've been yarning with Chris about his recent trip to, I guess, an Israeli prison, pretty much, you could say.
Yeah, yeah, that was the that was the secret ultimate destination.
Yeah.
The official destination was Gaza, but
before we get on to like you being locked up as well. How far did you get to the land, and how, like, what's the furthest somebody has made it?
Yeah, we made it about 42 nautical miles off the coast of Gaza.
What is that in?
In kilometres, I think a nautical mile is about 1.8 kilometres.
Oh, okay.
So we got reasonably close. Mm. International waters, like under international law, extend between about 6 to 8 nautical miles, maximum 12 nautical miles.
Mm.
So Australia's international waters start, I think it's about 8 to 12 nautical miles off the coast.
Yeah.
And under international law, if you're in international waters, you cannot be molested by a foreign power. You're entitled to safe passage, they call it.
Mm.
We were a long way out from Gaza in international waters when the Israeli Navy surrounded us and then forcibly boarded the boat. But the closest, I think, in 2008-09, the Freedom Flotilla actually made it all the way to Gaza. They got through, which was unexpected, but they got through. There's been multiple attempts since, and I think the closest anyone's got is 25 nautical miles.
Mm.
I'm kind of picking that figure out of my head, but it was about 25 nautical miles. That was in, I think, 2015, which was called the Women's Boat to Gaza.
Yeah, and that was with Marama Fox and some ladies from New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah. There was also, I can't think of her first name, May Reed. She was a Nobel Peace Laureate. Mm-hmm. She was on there as well.
And I think Marama Fox is an MP over there.
Yeah, she is. Yeah.
Greens? No.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Māori Party, maybe. I'm not sure. But she kind of went through the same thing that I went through.
And obviously they're tracking you the whole way through.
They are.
And you can see them, you know, like just tugging behind you? Or?
We could on the final day, we could. But in fact, when I arrived in Italy, in Sicily, in a place called Palermo, and the boats were all docked there. We were getting ready to go. We'd had a few days training, and we got raided 3 different times by the police, immigration and port authorities. I actually got detained on the boat in Italy because I didn't have my passport on for a few hours. I ended up sneaking off the boat after a few hours because I just thought, these are just bureaucrats. This is ridiculous. I'm going back to my hotel, and I snuck off and never heard another word about it. But we went to get on the boat in Palermo
And so did it have to be done in secret, or was it pretty open what you were doing?
It was open what we were doing, but we got a lot of grief from the Italian authorities. We also got a lot of support, I should say, from the local Italian authorities. The mayor held a function to welcome the activists.
Deadly.
Yeah, but in the end, they told the flotilla that they couldn't leave with the 22 people on board Al Orda, which was the boat I was on. They could only take 12. There was no real reason for that. So 10 of us had to catch a train to Messina, the other side of Sicily, and we had to board in international waters a few days later. And finally the trip got underway. It had a bit of a delay. Well, not a delay, but as we passed Crete, which is part of Greece, we were expecting a boat to come out from Crete to rendezvous with us, and a filmmaker called Jason Sue, who was on the boat, was supposed to get off, and he was supposed to take my laptop, my phone, my iPad, and freight it back to Australia. Twice that boat tried to rendezvous with us, and twice the Greek authorities stopped the boat.
Mm.
So Israel was putting pressure on countries all along the route, trying to make things as difficult for us as they could, and it worked, because in the end, on the final day, which was I think July 30, a Sunday, in the morning, we were approaching the area we thought would be where Israel would raid, and sure enough, we hear on the radio, on the ship radio, an Israeli Navy officer inquiring about who we were, and then for about an hour and a half, he kept telling us to turn around. We're in breach of international law, et cetera, et cetera. The captain of the boat kept telling him we're not in breach of international law, and we're not. I mean, the law on this is quite clear. There is – Israel's blockade is illegal. There's no real debate about that. So we kept going. Then a warship appeared behind us on the horizon a long way back. It would have been 7 or 8 nautical miles back, which is about as far as you can see. We could just make out the shadow of this big Israeli warship. And we kept going, and they kept telling us to stop, and we kept telling them we wouldn't. And then fairly quickly, we were surrounded by warships. So there were 2 major warships appeared beside us. There was the one behind us and another
How
one.
How big?
Oh, they're pretty big. Yeah. You wouldn't want to mess with them. They were pretty, you know. I've never been in that situation before, so it was quite surreal. And then another one appeared on our right, and 2 on our left, 1 behind us. And then we see this kind of weird kind of white water way in the distance, and then another 10 or so boats, smaller boats, appeared. There were 2 gunships, like, you know, fast patrol boats, and then a series of rigid Zodiacs, they call them, full of balaclava-clad Israeli commandos. And they sort of wheeled in behind our boat and then surrounded us, and things kicked off from there.
Well, and from that point onwards, what was that experience?
Look,
but before we got, or like you, they've boarded the boat. Some of you had you had to throw some of your belongings overboard.
Yeah, I did. That was one of the funniest parts of the trip. Funny, ha ha, in a way, but funny, ironic more than anything. As we got surrounded, I realised that there was. I tried to encrypt my laptop so that the Israelis couldn't get to it, but I realised that morning the encryption process wasn't going to finish in time. And even if it had, I didn't know what the Israelis have in terms of technology. And I'd been told they can crack your phone, they can crack your iPad, and they can crack your computer. And I've got a lot of sensitive documents on those things that I don't want to fall into other people's hands. Excuse me. So I made the decision as we were being surrounded to throw it all in the water. And I threw the phone in and the iPad in, and I kept a phone down in my luggage, which had nothing on it. It was just a burner phone. And I threw my laptop in as well, but it was in a rubber protective sleeve, and it floated. It literally just flipped on it. Yeah, it flipped on its side and started floating down the Mediterranean towards the Israeli warships that were kind of surrounding us. So it was a really difficult thing for a small independent journalist to get to the point where I was prepared to throw $10,000 worth of equipment away, but I got there. Only to throw it in the water and watch it float down towards the Israeli.
Did it end up sinking?
I never saw it sink, but, you know, I presume eventually it did. The ship was a long way back, so they would have had trouble finding it anyway. But it was pretty ironic that I got that. It took me days to get to that point where I went, yep, no, I've got to throw it. Because I can't afford to throw that sort of equipment away, but I did.
How long was it on sea in between?
10 days. It was 9 or 10 days it took. I think 10 days in the end. But we got surrounded by Israeli soldiers and boats, and it was exactly as I expected and as surreal as I expected. It was surreal being surrounded by warships, but it was even more surreal when they came alongside on both sides of the boat, just, you know, multiple boats with dozens of gun-wielding, balaclava-clad commandos. And they pulled up, and a woman's voice came over the microphone. It just literally said, "Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen." And I thought it actually reminded me like of a Mediterranean cruise. We were about to get some sort of tour guide talk us through the process. She tried to get us to stop and turn around, and obviously we weren't going to. The captain, a man named Herman Rexton, just ignored her and kept steaming along. Excuse me. And in a fairly short space of time, the rhetoric got a little bit more aggressive. They started demanding by name, "Herman, where are you, Herman? Come out, Herman. These passengers are your responsibility. Their safety is your responsibility." So there are a few implied threats. And then Herman ignored them, so they just quickly brought the first boat right alongside the Al Order and just started piling onto the bottom deck of the boat. We were all by that stage up on the top deck. So we just, I filmed Israeli soldiers just piling in through the bottom of the, onto the bottom deck, and we waited a minute or two.
Sorry. A little bit of water there or something.
Yeah, I do know. Yeah. Waited a minute or two, and they just started appearing on the top deck, all, you know, clad in balaclavas. But it wasn't initially as aggressive as people might think. They didn't have, they had tasers and what have you, but they, and they had guns, but they didn't have the guns out pointed at people. They were initially just engaged in some arguments with activists who were blocking the path to the bridge, which is ultimately what the Israelis were trying to get to, was get control of the ship. Mm. And it, you know, over the next few minutes, it, you know, there were heated debates and a bit of wrestling. One of the Israeli soldiers, we'd been told that they're often tasked with individuals, and a guy kind of made his way through the crowd and was made a beeline for me. And I was wearing a life vest, but it had a press, big press tag on it. And I was obviously a journalist. I was filming on a phone. The Al Jazeera boys, there were two journalists at the back. They had shoulder-mounted cameras, so they were obviously targeted early. I didn't see what happened to them, but by the time I was taken down, they had already been captured and were sitting on the back of the deck. But this guy sort of rushed towards me, and I kind of yelled, "Media, media," and just kept filming and stepped back, and he kind of stopped and looked a bit confused. He kind of turned around and walked back. I don't know why, walked back to the group. I kept filming, and he then had another crack, came towards me, and I was using a phone that an activist had given me, and she told me, whatever you do, don't let them get my phone. Just throw it in the ocean or in the sea, because it's got my kids' photos on it. It's an old phone. I'll replace it. But I'd been filming on a sort of a little SD card, which you can put in, a memory card, which you can put into the phone. So I filmed for a while on the SD card, and as they got closer, I pulled the SD card out, gave it to the activist. She hit it and actually managed to get quite a bit of that footage out.
Yeah, did he?
And as he came to me, came at me the second time and sort of swiped at the phone, I literally just kind of threw it over my shoulder into the drink, and that was kind of it. He just kind of looked at me like he was disappointed. There was no... He didn't beat me up or anything. He just looked a bit confused and disappointed, like, why would you just throw the camera in that you'd just been filming? He didn't realise, obviously, that I'd smuggled the footage from the memory card away. He told me to put my hands up. I put my hands up, and he ordered me to walk to the back of the boat with him. It was one of those surreal experiences for me, because I was there as a journalist, not an activist. But 10 days at sea with people in pretty confined circumstances, you get... You know, you form a bond. And as I walked past the bridge, a guy called Charlie Andreessen and Mike Treen, Mike was from New Zealand, Charlie was from Sweden. They were two guys I particularly liked. And they were kind of arms linked, hanging onto the bridge and trying to prevent the Israelis going through. And I very briefly considered linking arms with Charlie and just then joining the activists to resist. But I couldn't, because, you know, I'm there as a journalist. If they had footage of me participating in it, that's what they would have released. As soon as I write something, they'll just release something and say he's not really a journalist, he's an activist. So I had to walk past them. I walked past a guy called Yonatan Shapira, who was the only Jewish male on board. He served in the IDF himself. Kind of patted him on the back, said, "Good luck, mate." And that was it for me. I kind of walked to the back of the boat. They already had the two Al Jazeera journalists
at the back.
At the back. They had a few other activists out the back. They made me sit in the corner. And that was kind of it from my kind of witnessing of it. It went on for quite a bit longer. We heard Charlie and Mike were not complying. So we heard the tasers. They were tasing absolute daylights out of Charlie and Mike. They'd tased both of them in the face at one point. Mike had a cut on his cheek from the taser mark. Charlie was tased in the head and says that it, you know, as a taser, he's been tased by Israeli military before. That's his third trip. He says a tase in the head is just, it's just paralyzing. You just complete paralysis. They still didn't give up, and eventually they were cuffed with those plastic ties and kind of dragged to the back of the boat. Mikkel Guna, who was Gruner, who was the one of the crew. He was also brought back hogtied, and then they proceeded to flog Herman Rexton, the captain, in the bridge. He was headbutted. He was punched. He was punched in the body, in the face. He had his head slammed on the dash of the boat. The Israelis wanted him to restart the boat, but it's an old boat and it doesn't restart easily. You have to restart it from the engine room. So they flogged him and didn't believe that he couldn't restart the boat. He kept telling them he couldn't. They kept flogging him. This is him relaying the story to me afterwards, and it was witnessed by other activists who were being held on the front of the boat. One of them actually stood up to witness it, and she was forced to sit back down, and Herman was told by the Israeli soldier, "We don't want any witnesses when we execute you." That's what they actually said to him. Yeah. Oops. And it was very, I mean, it was intense to listen to, and it was intense to be told about it later.
Yeah.
Herman was eventually brought, well, the engineer, a guy called Arne, agreed to go down and restart the boat, provided that they stopped beating Herman. And they agreed to that, took Arne down, gave him a bit of a touch-up in the engine room, and kept beating Herman. Eventually they brought Herman down, and Herman said to the group, "I've just had the
daylights,
yeah. He used a different word, but I just had the daylights beaten out of me on the bridge." And he looked, his face was puffy, and he looked, you know, he looked pretty shaken. He was kind of thrown down on the mattress, or he flopped down on the mattress next to me and kind of just chilled for a while. He eventually, he'd taken some sort of medicine that the Israeli doctors had, and he basically eventually passed out on the deck next to me. He just kind of slept. And then we had a 10-hour trip from where we were taken to Ashdod. They rediverted the boat to Ashdod, which is the kind of nearest port in Israel. But what was interesting about it is, I mean, it was a brutal experience for some people. For most of the activists, it wasn't. But for some of them, it was. For me, it obviously wasn't. And the feature I'm writing kind of looks at that, because the experience that Palestinians describe face-to-face with Israeli soldiers is much more in line with what Herman faced, and worse, obviously. Palestinians are killed all the time by Israeli soldiers.
Where was Herman from?
Herman was from Norway.
Norway.
There's quite a big contingent of Norwegian sailors on the boat and activists. In fact, Norway had the Norway Freedom Flotilla Coalition had financed that boat, the Al-Order, with help from Australia and America and whatever. But, it was a pretty brutal experience for Herman. He's done that two times before as well, so that was his third trip. That was the most violent experience he'd had. One of the interesting things was that all of the soldiers, bar one or two, wore balaclavas. The soldier who, and they were all very young, clearly very young. And in Israel, kids have to serve 3 years national service. So when they turn 19, they do 3 years in the army or the navy or the air force. So the people they brought onto the boat were all predominant. Well, they initially brought kind of a goon squad on of older, bigger, more aggressive soldiers. And they replaced those people after about half an hour with a group of predominantly women and young soldiers. But what was interesting was that the people not wearing balaclavas, there were only a couple, were older and clearly just regular army, and also clearly psychopaths, people who enjoyed what they were doing. And the guy who had flogged Herman, we never found out who he was, obviously, but he wasn't wearing a balaclava. He was happy for himself to be identified. He just wore a pair of sunnies, and he came around after they'd dumped Herman and sat right next to this now 22 activist sitting on the back of the boat, and basically baited people for half an hour, trying to get some sort of fight going. He just sat there, and he made one comment. He laughed at one point, and he said, "We slaughter the kids of Gaza to make martyrs of Gazan blood." I'll never forget it, because I just was gobsmacked. I mean, what is this idiot doing? He's just flogged a guy on the boat. He was bragging about the fact that he wasn't wearing a balaclava. He was speaking in Hebrew directly to Yonatan Shapira, the former IDF soldier who'd clearly, he'd been on, I think, five flotillas before. He's a regular peace activist and a thorn in the side of the Israeli government. So he was quite well known. He was baiting Yonatan, and every time he spoke in Hebrew to Yonatan, Yonatan would translate to the rest of the group and tell them, ignore this man, he's simply trying to get some propaganda for his cameras. He wants people to make anti-Semitic comments, or, you know, he is trying to bait you, just ignore him. Yonatan was amazing, actually, a really inspiring guy, very brave too, because, you know, Palestinians face horrendous things in Israeli prisons, but... So do the Israelis who stand up against the Israeli state. So we were on the boat for another 10 hours on the way back. And speaking of Yonatan, as we got closer to Ashdod, it was nightfall by this stage. We'd been engaged by the Israelis by about midday, and then they'd boarded by about 1:30, 2 o'clock. We got into the port, I think, at about 11 at night. And as we kind of approached Ashdod, you can see the lights of Israel along the coast, and it's quite a scene. Israel's a very well-lit place. You could see Tel Aviv and Ashdod and Ashkelon and other places. And then there's this kind of black line and a few tiny little twinkles of lights. That's Gaza. Israel controls Gaza's electricity, so they cut it off all the time, and, you know, there's only a couple of hours at best of electricity a day for Gazans. As we approached the group realised that this would be the last time they were together, so they sort of sat in a circle under guard by Israeli guards and started talking to each other about their experiences and kind of talking to the group and thanking the group and whatever. And it's, for me, it was the most powerful moment of the trip. Yonatan, rather than address the group, actually addressed the soldiers who were standing watching. There's about seven soldiers guarding us. And he said things like, you know, these soldiers standing here, when they come to the end of their service, they'll go to Goa in India, or they'll go to Thailand for their three-month holiday, which is what they do, and they'll have to think back on their time in the Israeli Defence Force, and they'll have to think about the things they did and the things they participated in. And some of them will come to realise that what they did was not moral or just. It was part of an occupation, and it was brutal, and they won't be proud of what they did. And some of them will struggle, like I did, to come to terms with what they were made to do and what they participated in. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary speech. If I could have filmed it, you'd win a, you know, a Logie. It was that powerful. And if you'd filmed the faces of the
soldiers,
even though they had balaclavas, they were like half balaclavas that covered up from their nose down, but you could see their eyes. All of the soldiers were intently fixed on Yonatan, listening to what he said, and you could tell that they were. It was going through their head throughout that whole experience. You could tell at times that, particularly some of the most of the younger soldiers, particularly some of the female soldiers, were very uncomfortable with what they were doing. They weren't. They were trying to appear authoritative, but they weren't. They were just kids who were in a really indecent situation. I actually found myself having some empathy and sympathy for some of the soldiers. Not the psychopath, but some of the other soldiers. That doesn't excuse what they're participating
in. Of course.
At all. But I did. But these are young kids who are forced into national service and are made to do terrible things. Then what happened on that boat in the grand scheme of things compared to what happens to the average Palestinian wasn't terrible at all. But you could still tell there were people who were deeply uncomfortable with their part in the part they were playing in what was happening.
And how long was yours locked up for?
I was only in jail for 3 days. This is a kind of, you know, I say this with a caveat that I understand, you know, this might be, you know, I'm not trying to lessen other people's experience. My experience of prison was hilarious. It was 3 days. I haven't laughed that much in 3 days because it was so ridiculous. Is Israel, in its quest to create, excuse me, the perfect apartheid, they've created a kind of apartheid through bureaucracy. And I experienced this the previous trip to Israel. Just the levels of bureaucracy are staggering. And that's what I experienced being processed in the port and then sent to prison. It's just a bureaucratic fiesta. It is ludicrous. And, you know, that's not the experience of the average Palestinian in prison. And the point I'm kind of making in the feature is I'm a white Australian journalist. Of course I was going to experience things vastly differently to how the average Palestinian experienced things. But what I experienced in prison was, I mean, we were locked up the males were locked up and the females were locked up in a separate wing. And the males, they just kind of ran riot. They kind of ran the place.
Yeah.
The Norwegians particularly. I had no idea that Norwegians were as mad as they are. But I've now got a huge affection for Norwegians. They just kind of, they were, you know, they were demanding access to the Wi-Fi password from the Israeli Israeli officials. They were demanding to know where the emergency exit was in case of a fire and things like that. They're just messing with the prison officials. I got hauled before a court and warned by the judge that I was sitting disrespectfully. I was sitting with, you know, my legs crossed, and he told me, you are sitting disrespectfully. And I just kind of looked at him and kind of half laughed and went, really? At one point when I was being told I was held in custody, I'd been handed a sheet to tell me that, you know, you're entitled to make your case. And she said, you're being held in custody. I said, well, you number one on your form says I have the right to make my case. When do I make my case? She said, well, you already have. And I said, well, when did I make my case? She said, I asked you if you had anything to say and you said no. And I just went, that's because you're asking me a series of questions, and I thought you were, you know, I'd like to make my case. She said, sorry, that's just our process. She looked embarrassed. And, you know, that there was just this ludicrous, it took 10 hours to process this. There were hundreds of officials, probably 500 officials in this tent for 22 activists. So they were all yelling at each other at various points. It was just absolute bedlam and chaos. You know, and some of them were really nice to you. Some of them gave you food. Some of them were rude. Some, you know, it was just complete chaos, and it undermined the whole Israeli story that they wanted to project, which was this humane, you know, moral but serious army. In many parts, it was ridiculous. You know, I think we weren't supposed to see or hear the psychopath on the boat burning the captain. We were supposed to be given this image of this strong but moral army who look after these poor, misguided activists who've broken international law, which is, of course, rubbish. We broke no laws. The only laws that were broken by the Israeli military. The whole thing was a parody. You could get a six-part, you know, television comedy series out of it. But after three days, you know, I literally, prison is exactly what you would think it was. There's nothing to do. We had no access to books or television or anything. We just sat on our bunks, and we got a half an hour sometimes, twice a day. We were supposed to get an hour, but half an hour. In the rec yard, they would come crashing through the prison in the morning, yelling, banging doors and demanding you to get out of the bunk so that the commandant could come down and inspect you. It's exactly as you would expect. The food, inedible, like it was disgusting. I don't even know that some of what they've tried to feed us occurs in nature. I don't even know what it was. But some of the prison officials were really nice. There was one, I remember her name quite well, but I won't name her because obviously it could cause her problems. But she was really, really nice to me and a few of the other activists eventually. She gave me a prison job, so I was the kind of mopping the floors out in the hallway, which was good.
All 3 days while you were there?
Yeah, 3 days, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was an amazing experience because, you know, I got a sense of what a fake prison's like. I got a sense of, it was almost like being in a Big Brother house as a celebrity tourist to a prison. That's sort of the sense I got, because that is clearly not what most people experience when they go to prison. They're clearly not treated well. The Palestinians are brutalised in prison, but we were treated comparatively very, very well, even though, you know, the outrage of our freedom being denied and us being basically kidnapped, not basically, but under international law, kidnapped in international waters, taken to Israel against our will and held in prison for 3 days. I mean, that's outrageous at one level, but it was also ridiculous at another level. Because, also, you know, and some of the activists have since complained about that. That's what we were going there for. We knew that we would go to prison. I expected to spend about 3 days in prison. That's what I spent. I thought maybe six, worst case scenario. But eventually they, you know, I was convicted by Israel of, the court found that I had illegally entered Israel, which is deeply ironic, of course, because I was never headed to Israel, and I came to Israel under armed Israeli guard against my will. So I was eventually transported to the airport, held in a kind of prison van while they boarded the plane, and then they boarded me separately and stuck me in the back of the plane and flew me to Thailand, where I got detained as well. They took me straight from the plane to the cells in the airport at Thailand. I had to sit there for 5 hours, and then thank God for Qantas. I don't want to do free plugs, but Qantas was the flight from Thailand to Sydney, and they were exceptionally kind to me. I hadn't eaten really in properly in 3 or 4 days, so they gave me like 4 dinners and 3 desserts, and you know, they refused to serve me alcohol, which was kind of the final insult. But but I arrived in Sydney. And
how are the Herman, the driver, and the two guys who got tasered? You've heard from them since?
Yeah, I have. They're okay. Look, they're Herman is an activist. He would deny he's a member of Antifa in Norway, but I strongly suspect he is. he's definitely an anarchist, as was the chef, Jürgen, who also had been tased on the boat. They're all doing quite well. And look, I think looking forward to the next Freedom Flotilla. I am too. I learned a lot on that trip about how I would cover it next time. And, you know, we lost communications on the boat. When Israel surrounds the boat, they shut everything down, so there's no way to get anything off the boat unless you smuggle footage and whatever. So I've come up, you know, I've come up with a few ways that I'd like to try to get footage, more footage next time. We've got limited footage of the boarding, but
yeah, deadly. And also, so like, when's this article due?
Look, I'm still writing it. I'm going to write a series of features. Yeah. The first one is the boarding. The second one, I look at prison. The third one looks at the activists. And the final feature, there was an incident in 2010 where they killed 10 people, the Israelis, on a boat called the Mavi Marmara. Two journalists were killed and 8 activists were killed, summarily executed, at least 6 of them. So I'm going to revisit that, because the difference between the Mavi boarding and what I experienced couldn't be any more stark. And that plays to Israel's advantage in some respects, but it also is a disadvantage for Israel, which I ultimately is where I'll go with the feature. I'm kind of trying to make the point that, you know, people are critical of the Freedom Flotilla because they say it takes so much resources, and it does. It is an incredibly well-organized operation. I've got zero criticisms of the organisers of it. I think they did an extraordinary job. People say there's a lot of resources going into this, a lot of money. All you're really doing is getting a group of activists arrested. And that is true. That's all they're really doing. They're not getting humanitarian aid to Gaza, and that's not actually their primary aim. Their primary aim is to challenge the blockade. And the reason why that's their primary aim is to get coverage. Now, when I got back, there was zero interest in Australia from media, but other activists, Mike Treen, who returned to New Zealand, returned to a wall of cameras. Other activists in other countries returned to walls of media cameras. So Australia is, you know, spectacularly ignorant, not just about Palestine, but about Aboriginal issues, about so many issues. We're an apathetic, lazy nation, but that's not how it plays out in the rest of the world. And the thing that I think is so powerful about the coalition is that the only time you see media talking about Gaza is when Israelis are slaughtering them. That's usually the only time you hear. But this is an exception to the rule, where people do start talking about Gaza and the blockade and the conditions that Palestinians are forced to endure as a direct result of the actions of the Freedom Flotilla. And I am certain, 100%, you know, I thought about this a lot on the boat. The Israeli Navy is small. They're not a big armed force. And it's not a big nation either. But their Navy is small. And when in 2010 the Mavi and 7 or 8 other boats tried to break the blockade, Israel had a lot of trouble, and that's how they ended up killing so many people and torturing hundreds, according to the United Nations findings. They tortured activists. If the flotilla were to arrive with 50 or 100 boats the next time, say in 2019, I think you would see a vastly different outcome. Israel may get violent, but they know they can't again because they got in a lot of trouble for 2010. If 50 boats arrived, the Israeli Navy couldn't stop them. They would need to summon help from other nations, and I'm not sure that that help would be forthcoming. If 100 boats arrive, they're in huge trouble. And around the world, if you couldn't find 100 people with boats who are prepared to risk that to shed light on what's happening in Palestine, well, you know, I'm horse's bum. I think there is that level of support for Palestine. So, you know, let's wait and see what happens in 2019. But, yeah, it was an amazing experience.
Definitely. Hopefully more people get involved.
Yeah, it's well worthwhile.
Of course it would be, yes. You've been listening to Let's Talk. My guest on the program this morning is Chris Graham. We've been yarning about his recent trip to an Israeli prison and then a free trip back. He will be putting out some articles coming up very, very shortly. You've been listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM.